Ukraine's president says those suggesting he concede territory for the sake of peace are akin to the appeasers of Nazi Germany prior to World War II.
Кісінджер і говорить, що нібито треба віддати Росії шматок України.
Why is the Russian ruble rallying despite economic sanctions?
The ruble is no longer a kind of genuine measure of the health of the overall economy.
And later in the program, breaking Russia's worldwide civil nuclear power supply chain. Today is Thursday, May 26th. From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Ukraine. Good evening. I'm Steve Herman, in for Steve Miller. Ukrainian government officials say Russia appears to be escalating its aggression, especially in the eastern Donbas, where the Russians, with thousands of troops, are attempting to seize control of that region of Ukraine after failing to capture Kyiv. Ukrainian officials in Luhansk say there is now combat on the outskirts of the industrial hub of Severodonetsk, and Russian troops have advanced far enough to be able to fire mortars on the city while Ukrainian forces are retreating. However, the Ukrainian officials say the road out of Severodonetsk and Lysychansk remain outside of Russian control. If the Russians are able to capture those two cities, they would achieve one of their key goals of their invasion of Ukraine. Meanwhile, in Kharkiv in northeastern Ukraine, at least 7 civilians were killed and 17 wounded in Russian shelling, according to the region's governor. The occupiers are shelling the regional center again. Kharkiv Governor Oleh Sineobov wrote on the Telegram social media platform, urging residents to seek refuge in shelters. The country's president, Volodymyr Zelensky, has issued a stinging rebuttal to those in the West, suggesting Kyiv, for the sake of peace, cede control of areas occupied by Russian forces. Zelensky singled out for criticism the former U.S. Secretary of State Henry Kissinger, who this week made such a suggestion at the World Economic Forum in Davos. Zelensky says Kissinger has emerged from the deep past, seems to think it's 1938 instead of 2022, and that he was addressing an audience in Munich of those times instead of the crowd in Davos. That is a reference to appeasement to the Nazis prior to Germany's invasion of its neighbors that sparked the Second World War. The Ukrainian president added that his country still needs the help of partners, especially the supply of weapons, and in a high enough quantity to win. That's what those who really value people are talking about, said Zelensky in a video released by his presidential office. The resignation earlier this week of a veteran Russian diplomat, Boris Bondarev, over the invasion of Ukraine is an embarrassment for the Kremlin, but analysts say fear prevents most Russian officials from voicing dissent. More on this from Henry Ridgewell, reporting for VOA from London.
41-year-old Boris Bondarev forged a 20-year career in the Russian diplomatic service. Until this week, he worked at the United Nations in Geneva. He confirmed his resignation Monday in a letter posted on Facebook, saying, "Never have I been so ashamed of my country as on February the 24th of this year, the date Russia launched its latest invasion of Ukraine." Bondarev spoke to the Associated Press.
Of course, the war in Ukraine is a pivotal moment, because when there is no choice after that, there is only one choice, is to leave, to quit. Don't know for now what I'm going to do next. I'm thinking about it. Yeah, but I think if I have to go back to Russia, then the prospects may be not very, very pleasant.
The resignation will be embarrassing for the Kremlin, says Valery Solovey, a former professor at the Moscow State Institute of International Relations, where he taught several of Russia's diplomats.
Because the Kremlin was absolutely sure in loyalty of the Russian Foreign Office. I think that he reflects, Bondarev reflects general emotion of many of his colleagues in the Foreign Office, but it does mean that they are ready to follow him.
Solovey says Moscow has since conducted an urgent review of its diplomatic staff.
There will be more control outside the country, and maybe some who are in the list, were included in the list as potentially disloyal, will be removed from their embassies outside the country to Moscow.
The Kremlin will not be panicking, says analyst Alex Titov.
I wouldn't expect them to have, mass resignations.
Most officials remain loyal to President Vladimir Putin, says Titov.
Diplomats are, a special caste in a sense. They are selected for, they use their loyalty in many ways. They also have a lot of benefits. And, they are kind of these professionals which attuned to this idea of a hostility with the West.
The Kremlin has one method to ensure loyalty, says Solovey.
Fear and strong control.
Bondarev said he is fearful for his safety. Under Putin's rule, several dissidents living overseas have been killed or targeted by the Russian state, although Moscow denies such actions. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
During President Biden's trip to Tokyo this week, he participated in a leaders' meeting of the Quad, composed of the United States, Japan, Australia, and India. We know the war in Ukraine was discussed among these leaders, but the official 3,000-word joint statement issued after the meeting did not mention Russia, only referencing the tragic conflict in Ukraine and merely noting that the leaders discussed our respective responses to the conflict in Ukraine. Asked about this, State Department spokesman Ned Price said, "Obviously, we don't talk about the diplomacy that goes into creating joint statements," while he acknowledged India has a relationship with Russia that has developed over the course of decades. Joining us now on the program to discuss this is Dhruva Jaishankar, Executive Director of the Observer Research Foundation America. Dhruva, welcome.
Thank you, Steve.
Did you find that elliptical language in the joint statement surprising?
No, actually not at all. There have been other meetings, including a virtual meeting of the Quad leaders that was held in the immediate aftermath of Russia's invasion of Ukraine in early March, where they did discuss that topic. In fact, it was front and center in the agenda. And they did issue a joint statement that it did not make as critical a joint position on Russia because of India's traditional relationship with Russia. And there are multiple factors that have gone into this, both from a security standpoint. Russia remains India's largest supplier of defense equipment. And also, I think there are strategic reasons for it, which is there are deep concerns in India about growing alignment between Russia and China. And so for a combination of these and other factors, India has staked out a very different position on the Russia-Ukraine war compared to the United States and its longtime allies, Japan and Australia.
India obviously joined the Quad due to its combined strategic approach to China, India's biggest neighbor against which it fought a war in 1962 and with which it has ongoing border disputes. If war widens in Europe, would that not put India in a more uncomfortable position, assuming the other three Quad members would find themselves directly confronting Moscow?
In some ways, I think we're past that point. This year, you now have a full-scale invasion by Russia and Ukraine. This has taken many ups and turns. You've seen even the killing of civilians that India as well joined other countries in condemning. And if you do look at the tenor of Indian statements at the United Nations, they have taken a consistently harder position, rhetorical position against Russia at the UN, despite India not actually changing its votes. India's largely abstained on resolutions involving Russia and Ukraine. The other big development, I think, over the past several weeks has been consistent Indian engagement with the United States and its allies at multiple levels, from the president down to cabinet ministers, down to the working level, but also with the European Commission president coming to India recently. Japan's prime minister visited India. India's also engaged at very high levels with the UK, Prime Minister Boris Johnson. And the outcome of all of this is, I think, there's a better understanding on the part of the United States government and US allies in Europe, Japan, Australia, and elsewhere about India's position.
In an essay you co-authored in Foreign Affairs magazine, you noted that the lack of grain supplies due to the Russia-Ukraine war reinforces pre-existing concerns about economic vulnerability stemming from overdependence, and that global supply chains for the Quad and its efforts to shore them up may have long-term implications for the member states' economic and strategic relations. How so?
I think some of these are concerns that began earlier. The Russia-Ukraine war is in some ways the third stage of a series of major crises that have reinforced the notion for India, for the United States government, and for others as well, about the importance of resilient supply chains. So I think it started with a series of punitive actions taken by China against other countries for political reasons. So a notable example of that was the ban on rare earth exports to Japan, but also de facto sanctions against Australia, against several European countries for political reasons. The coronavirus pandemic accelerated that significantly. And suddenly, you saw medications in short supply, critical personnel equipment used by frontline healthcare workers and other such materials suddenly being in high demand and supply chains disrupted. The third factor, I think, was the Russia-Ukraine war. And suddenly, I think people found, whether it was wheat exports from Ukraine, certain mineral exports from Russia, in India's case, it was defense exports from Moscow. So this has led to, I think, a greater focus of many countries, including the Quad countries collaboratively. Janet Yellen, the U.S. Treasury Secretary, has referred to it as friendshoring, which is working with like-minded partners to ensure resilient supply chains. This was a theme that was highlighted in the Quad joint statement.
Dhruva Jaishankar, Executive Director of the Observer Research Foundation America. Thank you for joining us on VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. The United States, European Union, and Britain have jointly announced the creation of what they call the Atrocity Crimes Advisory Group. It is the latest international effort to help document crimes allegedly committed by Russian forces in Ukraine. U.S. officials say the new entity is aimed at directly supporting the Ukraine prosecutor's office in gathering evidence of war crimes and other atrocities committed there since the Russian invasion. State Department spokesman Ned Price says the Atrocity Crimes Advisory Group has two key elements.
The first is an advisory group to the OPG, the Office of the Prosecutor General, made up of experienced war crimes prosecutors, investigators, and other specialists based in the region to provide expertise, mentoring, advice, and operational support to the OPG. And the second component is something known as MGTs, or mobile justice teams, composed of both international and Ukrainian experts. These experts will be deployed at the request of the OPG to increase the capacity of the war crimes unit and regional prosecutors to assist the investigation on the ground.
The Atrocity Crimes Advisory Group will not overlap with the Conflict Observatory, which was unveiled last week, according to the State Department spokesman.
The observatory is a consortium working with, by the way, some of the same partners who are involved in this, but for a very different purpose. It is not to provide the sort of technical expertise, technical analysis, the writing of indictments, the forensics, the investigation on the ground of potential war crimes. The observatory is a hub to collect open source potential evidence pointing to war crimes, not only for authorities in various jurisdictions, but for the public, including to continue to shine a spotlight on what are clearly atrocities and apparent war crimes that are ongoing in Ukraine.
The European American and other team members of the advisory group will primarily be based in Poland, but are expected to make short-term trips into Ukraine. Russia denies committing war crimes in Ukraine. You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. I'm Steve Herman. After a one-month collapse from late February, after Russia invaded Ukraine, the ruble has reversed course and is on the rise. Overall, the Russian currency has surged about 30% against the dollar this year, and on Monday hit a near seven-year high against the euro. Wesleyan University Professor of Government Peter Rutland has been following this closely and joins us on Flashpoint Ukraine. Peter, it might seem counterintuitive that a currency would rise if its economy is being tightly squeezed by sanctions. What's going on with Russia and the ruble?
There's a couple of things going on. Russia continues to be able to export many commodities. Its oil and gas earnings have skyrocketed because of the increase in the price of oil and gas on world markets. And so they're pulling in about $30 billion per month in oil and gas revenue, and they're running a huge trade surplus. So despite the battering that the Russian economy is taking across the board, the oil and gas revenue mean that the ruble is still able to hold its value against the dollar and the euro. And then the second point is, with the suspension of the free exchange of rubles and dollars, the ruble is no longer a kind of genuine measure of the health of the overall economy. It's a regulated exchange rate that the central bank has been able to control pretty effectively.
You wrote a book titled The Politics of Economic Stagnation of the Soviet Union. In the longer term, are there parallels between the Soviet economy and the Putin economy that could foretell similar woes for the fate of the current Russian government?
Yes, very much so. I mean, even before the current crisis, there was a lot of discussion about Putin having kind of recreated the politics of stagnation of the late Brezhnev period. But now we're seeing the possible recreation of the economics of stagnation of the Brezhnev period. Because one difference between the post-Soviet Russia and Brezhnev's Soviet Union was that the Russian economy was highly integrated with the global economy. In the 1990s, the opening up meant that about 50% of Russia's GDP was traded, which is very high. It's kind of about the global average now, but it was much lower in the Soviet period. And Putin, even while Putin was restricting political freedoms, he kept that open economy pretty much in place. It's a disjunction between an illiberal political system and a fairly liberal, in the sense of open to foreign trade, economic system.
You've been studying the Soviet Union and Russia for more than three decades. Would you mind sharing with us any predictions on how President Putin and the oligarchs are likely to navigate their way around these Western sanctions? After all, it doesn't seem the elite will miss their Big Macs and Starbucks lattes too much, or suffer from the other high-profile withdrawals from Russia by Western companies.
Russia is a very unequal society in terms of the political power being concentrated in a small inner circle. And also the economic wealth that's generated has also been concentrated in that inner circle. And ordinary living standards had improved, certainly in the first decade of the Putin administration, but it pretty much stagnated after that. But the wealthy elite continued to get wealthier and wealthier. And now that the whole thing is being kind of slammed into reverse, we'll see what happens. I mean, the ordinary people's living standards will continue to stagnate, if not deteriorate. The upper elite has seen a lot of their wealth just wiped out overnight by the Western sanctions and asset freezes. But the inner circle will continue to have comfortable lifestyles, and the economy, it won't collapse. I think it will continue to kind of rumble along because of the oil and gas exports. And even though Europe might be able to cut off purchases of Russian oil and gas within the next year or two, China, India, and other places will be happy to buy that Russian oil and gas. And so that will continue to provide a kind of lifeline for the Kremlin, enough to keep them in power, enough for them to keep their army going. Nobody can predict what happens. The likelihood is that nothing much will change while Putin is still in power. And whoever replaces Putin will hopefully make a fresh start and try to get Russia out of the hole into which Putin has dug himself.
Wesleyan University Professor of Government Peter Rutland, thank you for joining us on Flashpoint Ukraine. Russia is a dominant player in the global supply chains for nuclear power reactor technology, and that should be a significant concern amid the war in Ukraine, according to a new research paper from the Center on Global Energy Policy at Columbia University. To discuss this, we're joined on Flashpoint Ukraine now by one of the report's co-authors, Paul DeBar, a former Undersecretary for Science at the U.S. Department of Energy. Welcome to the program, Paul.
Great to be here.
My first question, how did Russia achieve dominance in this space?
So there's a number of different segments, and there's certain kind of key ones where they have dominance, in particular in the fuel chain, which is in conversion, which is converting the uranium ore into gas that can be used for processing. And then most importantly, the enrichment process, which is to take that natural uranium and bring it up to the level that can be run in a commercial nuclear reactor. To a large degree, they reached this level of dominance for two reasons. One, they invested in their own centrifuges, their own capacity to do that. And then secondly, the United States has not invested in that domestic capacity. As we laid out in a report, we're an incredibly small portion of the market and very dependent. The Russians also have a very active commercial nuclear reactor export market. So a number of our allies around the world, for various historical reasons, such as Finland and the Czech Republic and Ukraine, are very exposed to Russian-built reactors that have been built by them in a period of time.
I know that nuclear power projects usually have timelines that can stretch decades. How quickly can Western countries and companies move to extricate their nuclear fuel chains from Russia?
The real bad part of this answer is that the existing Russian-built reactors around the world are going to be very hard for countries that have those, such as Hungary and Slovakia and so on, Ukraine. They're built, they're running, and if they need spare parts, they need pumps. It's natural to go back to the original provider, which in this case is Russia. They're going to have to try to find other companies who could make those components, such as Westinghouse in the United States. And on the new reactor side, there are various countries around the world that are looking at building new reactors that had entered into plans with Russians, like Bangladesh, Finland, Hungary, India, Turkey, that have either already through planning or they're halfway built Russian-designed reactors. There's a good chance that those countries may not want to continue to build those, and those would become sunk costs, as we would call it. All that investment by those projects in those countries, you know, would be lost, and they're going to have to start with scratch with a new provider of power plants.
Here in the United States and other countries, nuclear is in the mix of clean energy goals. Will the U.S. government and other governments have to make choices now between their green power goals and national security because of the nuclear connection to Russia?
Just from a policy point of view around non-emitting generation, there's a great degree of overlap and accomplishments around that goal and nuclear power. Nuclear power has significant value in the energy stack. It's non-emitting. It's available 24/7. It has great value over other types of energy, but it does have this exposure. Frankly, wind and solar, in particular solar with China, has significant overseas supply chain issues. So a lot of these technologies have supply chain issues. It's just becoming acute because of Russia's exposure to nuclear. There is a way for us to extricate ourselves off of the two largest portions that is Russia dominated, which is conversion and enrichment. But it's going to take investment by both the private sector of the U.S., but I think public policy is going to be needed by the U.S. government to help accelerate that, given how critical things are today.
Paul DeBar, who I should mention is a former U.S. Navy nuclear submarine officer and currently the chief executive officer and co-founder of Bohr Quantum Technology. Thank you for joining us, Paul, on VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine.
Thank you very much.
That is it for today's show. Stay up to date with continuing coverage on Ukraine and news from around the world 24 hours a day at voanews.com. And on social media platforms, just follow VOA News. On behalf of the entire Flashpoint Ukraine team, thank you so much for listening. Until next time, I'm Voice of America's Chief National Correspondent, Steve Herman. Have a good evening.
Of America, Washington, D.C.